Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and today I'm joined by my co-host and co-leader for tonight, Brandon Brownlee, where we are continuing our mini-series on the history of Western philosophy. Now, it's been a little bit contentious exactly what Western philosophy is. What we've been talking about mainly has been the pre-Socratic and Socratic eras of philosophy, and then the Platonic and Aristotelian eras of philosophy. So those are the times when Socrates was alive, Plato was alive, and Aristotle was alive. Today we're going to get into a little bit about what happened after the death of Aristotle. We enter an era of history which is termed by historians the Hellenistic and Roman period. So this is the period after Alexander the Great, who is very famous for being the fastest and most successful conqueror in the ancient period of history. He creates a vast empire, and then after he dies in his army tent trying to conquer India, his empire gets split into a bunch of Greek-speaking kings. And so there's a period of history roughly called the Hellenistic period, and then after which there's a period where Rome takes over and becomes the dominant force in the world. So in these periods of history, there were three main philosophical movements that came into being, citing from Encyclopedia Britannica. The period after the death of Aristotle was characterized by the decay of the Greek city-states, which then became pawns in the power game of the Hellenistic kings who succeeded Alexander. Hellenistic here means of Greek culture and speaking the Greek language. Life became troubled and insecure. It was in this environment that two dogmatic philosophical systems came into being, Stoicism and Epicureanism, which promised to give their adherents something to hold on to and to make them independent of the external world. The Stoic system was created by Zeno, who went to Athens as a merchant. He stayed at Athens and heard lectures of various philosophers, and after he had elaborated his own philosophy, he began to teach in a public hall I can't speak Roman very well, but
Stoa Poikile.
Thank you very much. Zeno's thought comprised essentially a dogmatized Socratic philosophy, which added ingredients derived from Heraclitus, 540 to 480 BCE. The basis of human happiness, he said, is to live in agreement with oneself, a statement that was later replaced by the formula to live in agreement with nature. The only real good for a human being is the possession of virtue. Everything else, wealth or poverty, health or illness, life or death, is completely indifferent. All virtues are based exclusively on right knowledge and self-control. Self-control being the knowledge of the right choice. Fortitude, the knowledge of what must be endured and what must not, and justice, the right knowledge in distribution. The passions, which are the cause of all evil, are the result of error in judging what is real, good, and what is not. Because it is difficult to see, however, why murder, fraud, and theft should be considered evil if life and possessions are of no value, the doctrine was later modified to distinguish between preferable things, such as having the necessities of life and health, completely indifferent things, and anti-preferable things, such as lacking the necessities of life or health, while insisting still that the happiness of the truly wise person could not be impaired by illness, pain, hunger, or any deprivation of external goods. In the beginning, Zeno also insisted that an individual is either completely wise, in which case he would never do anything wrong and would be completely happy, or he is a fool. Later, he made the concession, however, that there are people who are not completely wise, but who are progressing toward wisdom. Although these people might even have true insight, they are not certain that they have it, whereas the truly wise person is also certain of having true insight. The world is governed by divine logos, a word originally meaning word or speech. Then, with Heraclitus, a speech that expresses the laws of the universe, then finally, reason. This logos keeps the world in perfect order. Human beings can deviate from or rebel against this order, but by doing so, they cannot disturb it, but can only do harm to themselves. There's a little bit more here on the history and relationship of Stoicism to the Roman Empire, but I think we will skip over that section. Is there anything you'd like to comment on Stoicism before we go on to introducing the next line of thought, Brandon?
One of the things that gets emphasized about Stoicism is that it is as you mentioned in the ethical portion, it is a virtue ethics. Aristotle's ethics are also virtue ethics, but they take a radically different form here. I mean, with Aristotle, you have this idea of kind of configuration of the self. You have to have the right passions. You have to feel the right things in the right time in the right way. For the Stoics, the passions in the Greek pathos, something that you suffer, it makes a lot more sense why they would say that the passions are inherently bad once you understand what pathos means to have something kind of inflicted upon you or to suffer something. The experience of being passionate is the experience of being overcome by some external circumstance. And that's essentially the experience that grounds the insights into Stoicism. One of the other important tenets that you will see crop up consistently throughout Stoicism, but especially in the late and Roman period, is this distinction drawn and hammered in again and again and again of what is in your power and what is not in your power. Again, think about the experience of the passions. If you just think about that experience, it's easy to derive bad passions and good control. So that's very important, and we'll get into that when we speak about the others. But just those two things that are really important. Sorry, the other thing I wanted to mention about virtue is the sort of Platonic origins of virtue, or at least the Platonic origins of the Stoic understanding of virtue in this case. Because for the Stoics, virtue is what is unqualifiedly good for one. You think about heat, something being hot gives to the things around it its heat. In a similar way, and I'm following the commentary of Long and Sedley here, in a similar way, what is good benefits that around it. It has to qualify to do that. If something can in any way be used to, in a not good or a harmful way, a famous example is something like wealth. You can use wealth for bad things, or you can come to your own end through spending your own wealth. So wealth can't be inherently, unqualifiedly, without argument, it can't be good. And that isolation of the good is a Platonic notion. Just talking about the Aristotelian and Platonic lines of thinking that run through these. I mean, the Stoics didn't go to school with Platonism. They went to and attended the academy, but their origins are more or less in. I mean, their lineage is actually kind of interesting. Zeno studied with Crates, who was a cynic, and then he goes on to found Stoicism. So it makes sense that it would be a very practical philosophy, but the cynics...
Yeah, can you speak a little bit more to the cynics? Because I don't think we've covered that before on this miniseries.
Yeah, we'll touch on it a little bit, but the cynics are a practical school of philosophy that had to do with upturning social conventions and returning to a sort of, not a natural state, but they viewed what we called autarkeia, or self-sufficiency, as a highest good. That was their ideal. One of the most famous cynics being Diogenes of Sinope. People love to recall anecdotes about him, but what's philosophically important about him is seeing how in each case he renders himself self-sufficient in each case. When he sees a boy drinking water with his hands, he discards his bowl because now he has become more self-sufficient. He doesn't need to depend on a bowl.
And at that point in time, the bowl was basically his only possession.
I think it was a bowl and a staff.
So he literally had abandoned every type of materialism.
Exactly. And so Zeno studies with Crates, who was cynic, and he was told that Crates was equivalent to Socrates. And you have to understand too, at this point, and if you read Epictetus's Enchiridion, Socrates is cited as a sage. Socrates is kind of the sophos, the sage, the person who has achieved what philosophers are after. Reasonably so, if you believe Plato's depictions of him. And I mean, even the typical accounts of him, such as in Xenophanes, they're quite astounding. But in any case, what's really important is that Stoicism is a philosophy. It has theoretical components, but Zeno is mainly interested in the ethical components, which perhaps go back to his training in cynicism.
And I think that is a really important note about Stoicism, that it is linked to the Cynic philosophies, and especially to that idea of self-sufficiency, because that's something that I've never been able to articulate, but I've had a strong feeling that Stoicism, the ideas of Stoicism, are strongly linked to self-sufficiency and protecting yourself from your pathos, from the passions, achieving self-control and right living. But then what is the vision and purpose of mission of all of that? I think it really, the Stoics argue it's for self-sufficiency. It's for your own good and for the good of the world, that everyone be, I think, a little more self-sufficient or virtuous. But I think that is a really good principle to understand their idea of virtue from.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So next we're moving on to Epicureanism. The thought of Zeno's contemporary Epicurus 341 to 270 BCE, also constituted a philosophy of defense in a troubled world. Nevertheless, it has been considered, in many respects, justly, the opposite of Zeno's thought. Whereas Zeno proclaimed that the wisest person tries to learn from everybody and always acknowledges his debt to earlier thinkers, Epicurus insisted that everything he taught was original to himself. Though it is obvious that his physical explanation of the universe is a simplification of
Democritus's,
thank you, atomism, and whereas the Stoics had taught that pleasure and pain are of no importance for a person's happiness, Epicurus made pleasure the very essence of a happy life. Moreover, the Stoics from the beginning had acted as advisors of kings and statesmen. Epicurus, on the other hand, lived in the retirement of his famous garden, cultivating intimate friendships with his adherents, but warning against participation in public life. The Stoics believed in divine providence. Epicurus taught that the gods pay no attention whatever to human beings. Yet despite these contrasts, the two philosophies had some essential features in common. Although Epicurus made pleasure the criterion of a good life, he was far from advocating disillusion and debauchery. He insisted that it is the simple pleasures that make a life happy. When, in his old age, he suffered terrible pain from a disease, he asserted that philosophizing and the memory and love of his distant friends made pleasure prevail even then. Nor was Epicurus an atheist. His Roman admirer, the poet Lucurius, who flourished in the first century BCE, praised Epicurus enthusiastically as the liberator of humankind from all religious fears. Epicurus himself affirmed that this had been one of his aims of his philosophy. But although he taught that the gods are much too superior to trouble themselves with the affairs of mortals, he said, and his language clearly shows, sincerely believed that it is important for human beings to look at the gods as perfect, since only in this way could humans approach perfection. It was only in Roman times that people began to misunderstand Epicureanism, holding it to be an atheistic philosophy justifying a dissolute life, so that a person could be called a swine from the herd of Epicurus. Seneca, however, recognized the true nature of Epicureanism in his Moral Letters. He deliberately interspersed maxims from Epicurus throughout his Stoic exhortations. Yes, so I have read some of the letters of Seneca talking about Epicurus and Epicureanism, and he does speak to some of his teachings and hold them in high regard, but he also does try to kind of combat the misinformation of the day that Epicureanism is just about seeking pleasure, and it means that you have a dissolute lifestyle.
Oh, was it already kind of, Epicureanism was already understood to be, you know, like a frat boy philosophy?
It in Rome, that is what it had become known as.
Huh. Interesting.
Or at least there was an attitude among the Romans that that's what the philosophy meant. Maybe I mean, I'm not familiar with the exact history, but I think that would point to there were people who studied Epicurus who believed that's what it's meant and lived it out, and then brought down the name of the whole school of philosophy into everyone who believes it believed that.
Down but to this day.
That was misinformation.
Yeah.
At least if you read the direct writings of Epicurus.
So yeah, it's interesting because I think about like why that happened, but one of the theories I think is that Epicurus was kind of advocate. He has this famous saying, "Lethe bios," live in hiding, or you know, live on the down low, as it were. Don't get too involved in public affairs and whatnot. I think that is entirely consistent, obviously, with Epicurus, just because he says, you know, life is about pleasure. Fame is certainly a pleasure. Public recognition is certainly a pleasure, but he also has this idea of the negative hedonism. It's not maximal hedonism. It's yes, pleasure is the good, but you want to cultivate certain kinds of pleasures. You want to put yourself in a position to experience pleasure kind of purely and unrefined, or in a refined way. I remember the anecdote when I was taught Epicurus that he would permit himself a little treat, a piece of cheese, and that was his pleasure. But as also on his deathbed, he cultivated the garden, the Epicurean garden, where it was where he would have his disciples and students and whatnot, and they would be good friends. They would spend time developing pleasures worth developing, the pleasure of friendship, which is a subtle kind of pleasure. To go back to my theory, I think perhaps that the fact that it was kind of a live-in-hiding, and then he goes and hides in a garden, there's probably a lot of wonder about what was going on with all those intimate friends in the garden.
And you can also consider that these are Romans, so...
Yeah.
Romans don't, like, that would have been highly suspect, I think, for Romans. And I think just the whole idea of hiding from public life, that's not what the upper class of Rome was supposed to do. They were supposed to participate in the Senate, participate in the military. It's almost antithetical to the ideas of Roman politics to be uninvolved in public life. That's just not what it means to be Roman.
Yeah, to be a Roman, I mean, I get this from Arendt, but she says that to Romans, to be among people is a metaphor for being alive, and to no longer be among people is a metaphor for being dead.
Yes, so to exclude yourself from people, purposefully from public life, because you don't want to be involved in potentially political or other types of problems, that's definitely problematic for ancient Rome. So there is one last strain or strand of philosophical thought that we're going to talk about today, and then we'll go a little bit deeper into each of these streams of thought, and that is skepticism. So there was still another Hellenistic school of philosophy, skepticism, which was initiated by one of Zeno's contemporaries, Pyrrhon of Elis, who lived from 360 to 272 BCE, and was destined to become of great importance for the preservation of detailed knowledge of Hellenistic philosophy in general. Pyrrhon had come to the conviction that no one can know anything for certain, nor can he ever be certain that the things he perceives with his senses are real and not illusionatory. Pyrrhon is said to have carried the practical consequences of his conviction so far that when walking in the streets, he paid no attention to vehicles and other obstacles, so that his faithful disciples always had to accompany him to see that he came to no harm. Pyrrhon's importance for the history of philosophy lies in the fact that one of the later adherents of his doctrine, Sectus Empiritus, flourished in 3rd century CE, wrote a large book against the dogmatists, in which he tried to refute all of the philosophers who held positive views, and in doing so quoted extensively from their works, thus preserving much that would otherwise have been lost. It is a noteworthy fact that the British empiricists of the 18th century, such as David Hume as well as Immanuel Kant, derived most of their knowledge of ancient philosophy from Sectus Empiritus. Okay. So now that we've covered those three bases, there is actually a fourth one. Would you like to comment on skepticism before we get into the last one?
Yeah, I mean, skepticism is interesting because it's, in an important way, it's still alive in our epistemic tradition, in epistemology. When I was taught epistemology, I was taught Agrippa's Trilemma, which is the sunk clause of the skeptic, making knowledge impossible through a very scary argument. I don't know if I want to unleash this kind of what do we call them? Cognitive hazards, is it? People start disbelieving.
We can save that for another show.
Yeah, but I'm saying that skepticism is still alive, and it's a very productive doubt for producing all kinds of answers to things, trying to justify knowledge and whatnot. It's worth getting your brain eaten away by skeptics just to be able to, as the price of admission for some interesting epistemological theories, I think.
That's a very interesting perspective. I guess it's kind of the similar thing to what they say is, say when you need to build muscle, you have to break muscle down in order for it to build back stronger. So you have to read skeptics to become a stronger philosopher.
Yeah, I just find it interesting too that, the skeptics thought that this was a way to ataraxia, but when you read this stuff, or at least when contemporary people read this stuff, they just freak out. Oh no, knowledge is impossible. And then they have like a mini existential or epistemic crisis. So maybe they had different ideas about what, living in a troubled world looked like. Just lay it on me or something like that.
It is worth noting that both of these, the two previous ideas of philosophy that we discussed, those being Stoicism and Epicureanism, they were very dogmatic philosophies, and skepticism is more or less a kind of a place to go if you didn't want to be in those more dogmatic camps. And it does also seem that they're a little bit extreme, whereas the Stoics are literally the holders or advisors of the people in power, and the Epicureans are the people who are like, we want nothing to do with those people. Well, if you're an everyday person, you're probably not in either of those groups. So you're probably more in line with the skeptics. I do think that the most interesting thing here is that David Hume and Immanuel Kant, some of the most famous Enlightenment thinkers on skepticism, they derived most of their knowledge of ancient philosophy from a practitioner of skepticism. So, I mean, that shows a little bit of the historical bias of Enlightenment thinkers. There was, of course, the humanist movement that was developing some of the standards of literary criticism and critical thought, and in terms of understanding where we get written works, and then trying to be faithful to the original intent of the authors of those works, understanding cultural context. That begins, well, pre-Enlightenment. But that movement, I think, hopefully informed some of David Hume and Immanuel Kant's perspective. Hopefully they didn't just take Sextus Empiricus's word for everything that he said about ancient history, but then again, they may have had no choice. He might have been the only source that they had at that time. All right, so our last entry into the ring of Hellenistic and Roman philosophies is Neopythagoreanism and Neoplatonism. I'm not sure why those are grouped together, but I'm sure we'll get into that in a little bit. So all the philosophical schools and sects of Athens that originated in the 4th century BCE continued into late antiquity, most of them until Emperor Justinian I, who ordered them closed in the year 529 CE because of their pagan character. Within this period of nearly 1,000 years, only two new schools emerged, Neopythagoreanism and Neoplatonism. Both were inspired by early Greek philosophy, though only the latter would become historically important. Neoplatonism was established in the early 3rd century, someone who had been brought up as a Christian but had abandoned his religion for the study of Plato. So Neoplatonism, there are several thinkers. We won't go into all of the details here. They are somewhat religious and mystical in nature. Plotinus, it says here, assumed the existence of several levels of being, capital B, the highest of which was that of the one or the good, capital O for one, capital G for good, which are identical but indescribable and indefinable in human language. The next lower level is that of pure intellect or reasoning. The third is that of the soul or souls. And there it follows that the world is perceived by the senses. And then the final is the lowest level of matter, and that which is the call of all evil. So I'm not going to go too much further into Neoplatonism, but it is worth noting because the Neoplatonists, while their pagan philosophy gradually died out, it continued to influence the development of Christian philosophy and theology. So once we get into our next show or in a couple of shows on medieval philosophy and the history of Western philosophy, that will become more relevant. Okay. Do you have any comments, Brandon, before we go a little bit deeper into things?
Yeah, just to comment on why Neopythagoreanism and Neoplatonism might be associated with one another. I mean, it's because of the association between Pythagoreanism and Platonism, ultimately. I mean, Plato, and so Platonism is based on the notion of a cosmos, which the Pythagoreans discovered when they started plucking with strings. They found that as you moved the bridge on a string and you plucked it, there was a ratio to the change in pitch on both sides of the bridge. So that means, and the Pythagoreans saw this as a instance of order and proportion instantiated in the world. There is a cosmos. And I mean, Plato picks that up by incorporating that into his theory of forms. Ultimately, everything is organized by a form of the good. I mean, Pythagoreanism influenced Platonism in that the Pythagoreans saw order in the world. They called this a world order, a cosmos. The Stoics pick up on this as well, but this is originally a Pythagorean insight, and they saw it on the Pythagorean lute, which is just a one-string instrument with a bridge, and as they moved the bridge around, the string, and you pluck the string on both sides, the string's proportion, or the pitch of the strings on each side move in proportion with one another. So, and the Pythagoreans took this as proportion existing in the world. The world is an intelligible whole. There's proportion to it, and this influenced Platonism in that the world has an intelligible component to it, or it shows itself an intelligible, or it refers to an intelligibility that is of another world. For Plato, the world of forms, but nonetheless, what we see and what we live in are instantiations of otherwise intelligible things. I mean, there's plenty of other things too, like the Pythagorean doctrines of the soul and reincarnation and whatnot. But essentially, most philosophers are indebted to Pythagoreanism as is noticing the intelligibility of the world.
So, how is the idea of cosmos different from the idea of logos? I mean, they obviously arised out of different philosophical investigations. Cosmos, like, arising from that analogy of the Pythagorean lute and the idea of proportion, and logos arising out of, as we mentioned earlier, the idea of self-sufficiency and looking after oneself. So, which was then later adapted to be being rather than one with oneself, being one with nature, being one with the order of reality. So, I mean, I guess that's a very crucial distinction, actually, in philosophy, is what do you use to create your reasoning behind what gives order to the universe, or is there order to the universe? Is it observable phenomena like the Pythagorean lute, physical analogies, Or is it something like the social aspects of life, as we saw with Epicureanism,